Donald Trump has pardoned all the thugs who stormed Congress, even those who bashed up the cops, all home free after one of the biggest investigations and mass prosecutions in American history. He's even sprung from prison the former Honduran president, Juan Orlando Hernandez, serving a 45-year sentence for, amongst other things, dispatching 400 tons of cocaine to the United States. This power to pardon goes back, of course, to the earliest days of the Republic, that strange republic that gave its president so many of the powers of a monarch, including the royal prerogative of mercy. Professor Saikrishna Prakash, a distinguished legal scholar at the University of Virginia, has just published an important book on this strange aspect of the United States Constitution. It's called The Presidential Pardon, The Short Clause with a Long, Troubled History. Sai joins us from Virginia. Welcome to Late Night Live.
It's a pleasure to be with you, David.
Sai, you write that America has now reached a position of pardon dystopia. What do you mean by that?
What I mean, David, is that presidents are now using pardons as instruments of politics rather than as instruments of mercy or national reconciliation. So they're running on promises of giving pardons to their supporters. They're giving pardons to campaign contributors and business associates. Of course, they're giving pardons to family members. And so they're using a pardon power that's supposed to be used for purposes of state building and mercy to further their own political interests.
And this is new?
It's always been there in the background. There's always been suspicions about this, going back to John Adams, where he pardoned a bunch of rebels in Pennsylvania, and people thought he was doing so in part because he wanted to get more votes in Pennsylvania. And then, you know, there have been other examples. Andrew Johnson issued a pardon on the first day of the Democratic National Convention, and he was told that if he gave a pardon, he was more likely to get the nomination. He didn't get the nomination, but he clearly timed the pardon for the first day of the convention. And then, of course, Bill Clinton issued pardons to a campaign contributor, or more precisely, a presidential library donor, Mark Rich, and pardoned several groups that were useful to Hillary Clinton's campaign for Senate. Joe Biden ran on a marijuana pardon, but Trump is taking this to a new level.
Those 20 words in the Constitution, why were they put there in the first place? Because I take it from what you write that there were those worried about it from the start.
Yes. So, you know, every legal system has a regime or a mechanism by which they can mitigate or eliminate the penalties associated with violating the law. The idea is that some people deserve mercy because it turns out they were innocent or because they've lived exemplary lives since their punishment or since they were put in prison. Sometimes there's a need for reconciliation, say if there's a rebellion. This was certainly a feature of the English pardon power, where the crown would periodically have to issue an amnesty to pacify a rebellion. And when the founders thought about pardons, they were familiar with them because they came from Great Britain as a, you know, we were all colonies before we were states and a nation. So it was just natural to have a pardon power, and the question was how it would be vested. And they thought on balance it worked better to give it to one person rather than, say, giving it to the legislature to exercise, because back then the legislature wasn't always in session. And I think the thought was rebels aren't going to lay down their arms if they have to wait for the legislature to issue the pardon. They will lay them down if the president promises them a pardon. So I think they just thought it would be better vested in one person's hands.
And the words are, he shall have power to grant reprieves and pardons for offenses against the United States, except in cases of impeachment. But say, this power in the United Kingdom was exercised on the advice of the government. It wasn't personally held by the monarch. But of course, the United States doesn't have a government. In that British sense. So it's a personal power, much stronger than it ever was in Britain. Is that right?
Well, I think, you know, the British Constitution changed over time. Obviously, today the Crown is more of a figurehead, a head of state, rather than someone who wields real authority. But I think in the 17th and 18th century, the Crown did issue pardons without regard to any advice they might get from their ministers.
Yeah.
So there was this tradition, at least in the 16th century and earlier, I forgot when it ended, maybe the 17th, of coronation pardons. When monarchs came into, when they were crowned, they would issue a coronation pardon as a means of celebration. And this was just a regular staple of British policy for a long time. And they would exclude various really heinous offenses, but back then, lots of offenses were punished with death, even what we would consider minor offenses. I don't know at what point the ministers exercised an effective veto on the crown's pardons, but I'm not sure it was until, I don't think it was until later, maybe after the U.S. Constitution.
Right, but once again, the British system shows its strength by not being written down. and therefore able to evolve. I hadn't realized until I read your book that pardons come in different forms. Pardons, commutations, remissions, amnesties. Tell us about the various forms of pardons that the US president can grant.
Sure, David, I'd be delighted to. So the Constitution mentions pardons and reprieves. A pardon is a full grant of mercy. It sort of effaces the conviction and eliminates any consequences from the conviction. A reprieve is just a temporary respite in the punishment, right? If you are about to face an execution, you might be given a reprieve and then the execution won't take place until and unless the reprieve is lifted, or, you might get a pardon, in which case there'll never be an execution. Those are mentioned in the Constitution, but the language reprieve and pardon is taken to mean that the president can also issue a commutation, which is basically reducing the sentence or reducing the fine. You may have received a 10-year sentence from a judge, and maybe the president will reduce it to 2 years. You may have received a $1 million fine from the court, and the president might reduce it to $10,000. So that's what's called a commutation. Another form of clemency would be an amnesty, and an amnesty is a grant of some form of clemency to multiple people, often thousands, all at once, and you just sort of describe the offenses and describe the category of people that will receive it. And that's the kind of clemency that you would see in the wake of a rebellion or in the wake of widespread lawlessness or violation. So Jimmy Carter pardoned draft dodgers in 1977 because he thought it was time to put the Vietnam War behind us. Andrew Johnson and Abraham Lincoln pardoned a lot of the Confederates.
Yeah.
And that's what Trump did in the wake of, on January 20th when he resumed the presidency for a second time.
And there are conditional pardons that exempt people from punishment as long as he or she, I suppose, lives a clean life of some kind, but conditions are placed on a pardon.
Yeah, you can put conditions that are, that you have to satisfy first or conditions you have to satisfy for the duration of your life, or you can put them both, right? So for a rebellion, what you would say is you've got to lay down your arms and you get a pardon and you have to continually be peaceable, right? Because they don't want you to take them up again. And so there's a condition precedent and a condition subsequent. Sometimes the conditions are you just have to, maybe you have to admit your guilt and you get a commutation, or, you have to do something in return for getting the commutation or the pardon. Or as you said, you have to refrain from doing something going forward. And of course, that raises the possibility of all kinds of conditions being placed that one might think are nefarious, right? So,
yes. They could be that you continue to finance the president. I'm just in the evil part of my mind, which quite a large part of my mind is just working away here. But the fabulous thing I've discovered from you is that a grant can't be undone, a little mistake that Donald Trump made.
I'm not sure what you're referring to, David. Did Donald Trump try to retract a pardon?
He tried to retract all the pardons that Biden had granted.
Well,
discovered he couldn't. Poor man.
Donald Trump's theory of that case is that Biden didn't make the pardons. And of course, if Biden didn't, issue the pardons, Trump wouldn't need to retract them. They wouldn't be valid, right? If let's imagine that, Joe Smith was the one who actually issued the pardons in Biden's name and Biden had nothing to do with them. Well, then there would be no retraction because they just were never valid to begin with.
Of course.
The problem with Trump's theory is that he wants to say that Joe Biden wasn't mentally fit to issue the pardons. And that's never been tested before. I suppose it's true that if, you know, Joe Biden was in a coma and they used, you know, they manipulated his hand to sign a bunch of pardons, those wouldn't be valid. But in the absence of some compelling evidence that Joe Biden didn't issue those pardons, it's just talk on the president's part. And it's further kind of talk because unless the president's going to try to jail those people or prosecute them, it doesn't matter, right? In other words, a pardon has a practical effect in the real world if the executive just chooses not to prosecute someone because they think this person has a valid pardon. So if Trump was really serious, he would try to put these people in jail or prosecute them. They would then raise their pardon, and then we would find out. But he's not doing any of that, right? It's just a way of...
It's talk.
It's a way of diminishing President Biden, but nothing's going to come of it as far as I can tell.
On Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Sai Prakash about his history of the use of the pardon in America. Sai, let's go right back to the beginning. When was the first pardon granted? By whom? Why?
So Washington is the first pardoner because he's the first president, and he's getting petitions for pardons. And Washington is, you know, my sort of ideal pardoner-in-chief, the ideal, you know, issuer, dispenser of
mercy.
You
write about him in the most glowing terms, yes.
Well, he's a wonderful president and, you know, I think an exemplary person. So what he does is he gets the input of the prosecuting attorney, the judge. He, of course, reads the petition for a pardon by the prisoner who wants the pardon. And then he mulls it over and he really thinks long and hard about it and he comes to a decision. And, you know, he has more time in that era. There are fewer people who have been convicted. He, of course, is the first president. And so there isn't a backlog of pardon applications like there is today. But he takes it very seriously and he's doing this all himself. And, you know, he's looking for advice. And then his pardons, they're public documents. They actually say, you know, greetings to all whom see these presents, greetings. You know, and then he describes who he's pardoning, for what offenses, and then he critically tells you why he's pardoning them. He tells you, I think this person is innocent, or I think they've, you know, repented, or I think, you know, they've already been punished sufficiently. Because he knows that these are public records and they're public, he wants to give public sounding reasons, not have it just be viewed as some arbitrary process on his part. And so he lists multiple reasons in a way I think that's quite useful and helpful for the public because they want to know, well, why is this person being pardoned? So Washington is the first person to do it.
But the habit of giving reasons and setting it all out in public has long gone.
Well, they're often saying something in these pardons, but the president, it's very hard for the president to review the thousands of applications that are given to them today, and they're not really preparing, you know, the language of the pardon. And so it's other people that are preparing memos and lists of people that they think ought to be pardoned, and the president then reviews those lists, and then someone else is preparing the pardon and giving reasons. You know, famously, when Gerald Ford pardoned Richard Nixon, he gives about two dozen reasons because he knows it's going to be controversial. It's just more reasons than you can possibly imagine. And Joe Biden gives reasons for pardoning his family. It's just that one sometimes doubts the reasons that are publicly stated in a way that I don't think is true for Washington. Part of that is, I guess, my cynicism of, you know, the reasons that people give today as opposed to the past. But, you know, I suppose in the future someone might think that Trump or Biden, you know, are the ideals of, you know, they're the ideal statesman. I can't see it happening, but it's possible.
You actually admire the pardon that Ford gave Nixon, very, very controversial pardon. There was a huge appetite to see Nixon prosecuted after Watergate. Why do you think that was ultimately a good thing?
Well, I think, first of all, you know, there were allegations or suspicions that there was a corrupt bargain that Nixon would resign in return for making Ford president, and then Ford would, you know, pardon Nixon. I don't think that that's, I don't think any such deal was made. And so when Ford is pardoning Nixon, I think he really believes that it's best for the nation to put the episode behind us. And I think all I meant to say is that I think he was sincere in doing that. It's a harder question to answer whether or not Nixon should have been prosecuted. But I think what I was trying to say was that I trust Ford's motives. And in fact, you know, he suffered, I think, quite a bit for issuing the pardon, something that you wouldn't do if you thought, you know, you might not pardon someone if you thought you would suffer for it, unless you think perhaps that it's better for the country. So it's not clear that Ford ever recovered from that pardon.
Let me engage your lawyer's mind. Here's my scenario. 2 days before the end of his term, Donald Trump stands down and is replaced, if only for 2 days, by J.D. Vance as president. Vance then pardons Trump for everything he's done, perhaps in both terms as president, and those pardons protect Trump forever. Would that work?
So this was actually discussed by the Nixon lawyers. They said that Nixon could not pardon himself, but they said he could step down. They said temporarily he could step down temporarily, and then Ford could pardon him, and then Nixon could resume the office. I think, you know, it sounds terrible, and I think it would be terrible because it would seem as if he was resigning only to get the pardon, obviously. But I think that's possible. Yes, I think I think it would be legally effective. I think it would spur a reform. I don't, you know, Trump has a grip on the Republican Party, but all grips on parties by presidents decline over time, right? The Democrats recently kind of jettisoned President Clinton. They don't care that he's being forced to testify before Congress. Many of them voted against him. And at some point, Trump's grip will decline on the Republican Party, and then maybe they will decide that this is just a terrible idea. Terrible for the vice president to pardon the president, you know, because the vice president is obviously beholden to the president. The president chooses the vice president.
It would look squalid. Do legal scholars like yourself, perhaps even a wider range of people in the United States, think that perhaps it'd be a good idea to just start all over again with a new constitution? You know, start from scratch and fix all this up. What about that as an idea?
Well, I think opening up the entire constitution might prove more daunting and more difficult than just amending the pardon clause. So I think you're right that there are people in the United States who believe that the constitution is outdated. Others, you know, believe it ought to be changed in certain respects. But if you reopen the entire thing, you run the risk that it gets opposed by powerful interests such that nothing gets changed. It might be easier to change it on a piecemeal basis.
I'm a utopian, you see. I'm filled with large dreams. But let's just look at the clause itself, the pardons clause. Is there any political will to just get rid of it?
Well, I think there are some people who are talking about it now, even more so than, you know, when I finished the book. I think the problem is that there are other people who think that criminal punishments are too harsh, and they like the fact that the president can mitigate them, right? There are some people who want more pardons, not less. They want less pardons that are partisan or political or designed to further the president's interests. They want more pardons or commutations that will lessen the harshness or the severity of, you know, federal laws. And if you want that, diminishing the president's power would be counterproductive unless you have some other mechanism for, you know, another body to issue pardons. And so the book discusses reforms, perhaps making it harder for the president to pardon, perhaps giving other people the power to pardon, maybe a House of Congress or, you know, a body of experts who would wield the pen. Because it's, you know, it was easier to get a pardon in the 18th and 19th century because there were fewer people and fewer pardon petitioners. Now it's really hard because there's so many people who have been found guilty of a federal offense. And of course, as the book notes, You don't even have to be prosecuted to receive a pardon. The president can pardon you in advance of any prosecution.
Do we have any idea how long the queue is at the moment? How deep the documents are on the pardons office desk?
Yeah, I think what's happened is the pardon office sends candidates to one of the attorney generals, the deputy attorney general, and they forward it on to the White House. And my recollection is it's several thousand people long. And part of what's going on is, you know, presidents don't mind pardoning their friends and family and political allies. They are more concerned about pardoning someone else they don't know who then goes and commits a crime because they will be held responsible for it. And so, you know, there's a certain reluctance to use a pardon pen for people who don't have connections to the White House, right? One of the themes of the modern presidency is if you know someone in the White House, your chances of getting a pardon are astronomically higher.
And haven't we read reports that some of those pardoned after storming Congress have committed fresh crimes?
Well, I think there are people that, you know, have received a pardon and have committed other crimes. Yes, most certainly. And, you know, I think there are people that have received two pardons, right? They committed one crime during the first Trump. They committed a crime. They got pardoned during the first Trump administration. And I think they've received another pardon for another crime they committed or were prosecuted for during the Biden administration. And of course, people believe in mercy, but you might wonder whether, you know, other people were more, you know, were more worthy of mercy than the person who had already committed an offense and been pardoned for it once.
Si, thanks so much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you so much for having me, David. It's been a pleasure.
I've been talking to Professor Si Prakash, distinguished legal scholar at the University of Virginia, about his book on the history of pardons, the presidential pardon, the short clause with a long, troubled history. This is Late Night Live.